Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, civil disobedience.
Ken, civil disobedience is a great tradition. Particularly in America, we have Henry Thoreau, who refused to pay a poll tax because the money supported the Mexican War and the fugitive slave law. Then there's Rosa Parks, who refused to sit in the back of the bus, and Martin Luther King and the Vietnam War protesters.
John, I certainly admire all those civil disobeyers, but tell me, exactly what is civil disobedience? Suppose Henry Thoreau and Henry Smoe both refused to pay their poll taxes. Thoreau does it for the noble reasons you just mentioned, but Schmoe does it because he'd rather spend the money at the pub, frankly. They're both disobeying a civil law. They're both, in a literal sense, civilly disobedient. But what's the difference? Just that Henry Thoreau had good intentions and Schmoe didn't?
Well, his good intentions are part of the mix, but specifically, he was trying to influence policy. And he was trying to influence by exercising free speech. I mean, his disobeying the law was a speech act, an attempt at communicating his feelings about the unjustness of the law.
Okay, does it have to involve a protest? What if Thoreau's grouchy cousin, his grouchy, uncommunicative cousin Larry Thoreau, didn't pay his poll taxes either, and he also didn't want to support the fugitive slave law and the Mexican War, but he didn't go around boasting about it, he didn't go around telling anybody about it. Would that be civil disobedience?
Well, Ken, you know, civil disobedience isn't a scientifically precise concept. I can't give you a definition with no holes in it. I think it's better to list some traits that a paradigm case of civil disobedience has. Let's try to do that. I mean, for one thing, it will be a refusal to obey or follow a law that is itself unjust or believed unjust, like the law against making salt that Gandhi broke, or the law that supports unjust policies, like the poll tax. That's a start. I admit it doesn't tell us the difference between famous Henry and grouchy Larry.
Well, but here's a way to think about the difference between Larry and Henry. Gandhi and Thoreau weren't just disobeying the law, but protesting the law and policy, and they were doing so publicly. Their acts were speech acts as well as acts of disobedience. They were done openly, and they didn't attempt to escape punishment. Same for draft card burners and those who sat in at shops that refused to serve blacks. So that eliminates grouchy Larry, because he's not doing any of those other things.
Well, okay, so that contributes to our paradigm. In addition, usually we have in mind nonviolent activities like sit-ins and marches. The intent is to change things, to get the law repealed or the policy changed.
So now we have a paradigm act of civil disobedience. Disobeying or refusing to follow a law or a policy believed to be unjust or supportive of unjust injustice, doing so publicly and nonviolently with the intent of drawing attention to the law or policy and with the intention of getting it changed.
Okay, so that's our paradigm. Now that leads to the next question. We admire all those people we mentioned. Thoreau, Gandhi, King, and the student boycotters in the 60s. But does that mean that they were right to break the law? How can it be right to break a law?
Well, in those cases, we, the admirers, think that the laws or policies were unjust. But how about a crowd nonviolently blocking the entrance to an abortion clinic in contravention of the law? I don't happen to think that laws that allowing access to abortion or to abortion clinics are unjust. But these people do. Does that make them morally right?
Well, that raises a more extensive problem. We admire those who protest the laws we think are unjust, but we're part of a democracy full of people with very different values. We're supposed to settle things by voting or having our representatives in legislatures and Congress vote. But any law or policy on a controversial issue is likely to go against someone's deeply held beliefs. Does that give them the right, the moral right, to disobey it? It sounds like that's going to lead to chaos.
Well, it seems to me that you're suggesting that in a society like ours, where there are other remedies like voting and taking things to court, those methods should be tried first and civil disobedience should be a last resort.
Well, maybe that's ideal, but if there's time, it might be a pressing issue. There's not time to go to court. You might not have the money to hire a lawyer or a congressman. Sometimes it seems like civil disobedience has to be the first resort, not a last resort, because it's the only way to make anybody care about the issue.
Well, you know, we've got plenty to talk about for the next hour, John.
And we've got a guest to help us, Kimberly Brownlee, professor of political philosophy at the University of Manchester.
And we want our listeners in the mix, too. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Julie Napolin, talks to a civilly disobedient protester in that city known for civil protest, Berkeley, California. She files this report.
It's hard to think of UC Berkeley without thinking of civil disobedience. In 1964, when the university banned all political activity on campus, Mario Savio took his famous stand against censorship before a crowd of 4,000 people, just before being arrested.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part.
The Berkeley campus has changed over the years, and so have the machines. Today, most students milling around campus listen to iPods or talk on cell phones. This makes it hard to hear the free speech coming at them from one local street performer, Stony Burke.
You know, they say this is the melting pot, where the scum rises to the top.
iPod person, come back.
Her iPod's more important.
In 1977, Stony started yelling about politics and daily life on the campus plaza.
I didn't really get radicalized until I got arrested for doing it.
He began performing each week and was arrested more times than he can count. While he was just being uncivil and disruptive, the police continued to arrest him.
In the beginning, it would be something like vagrancy or begging, or, you know, just some kind of hassle thing. And it just kind of reinforced, I think, something very fundamental in me and all of us, that you have to have a person out there talking. No, not blogging, not making a giant movie, not, you know, brandishing a gun, but just somebody talking outside. There's no security guards. There's no ticket to get in. You know, it sort of breaks the codes.
Tedford, resign!
When people with headphones walk by, he blows his whistle just outside class windows. That and his bellows disturb classes. The noise is not just disruptive. For Stony, it's about breaking social codes to demonstrate their injustice.
Whether you're playing a folk song, or whether you're juggling, or whether you've got a three-person comedy group, or a women pop singer, whatever it is on the street, there's so many restrictions, people are really discouraged from doing it.
Sometimes, students crowd around Stony, and he creates a temporary community free from those restrictions. He hopes students will get so annoyed, they might become more disruptive too.
My whole concept of just get them in a circle. Once you do that, it's all over. They've created their community.
If you'll gather around me, children, a story I will tell.
I guess Woody Guthrie is the closest thing I've ever, that if you could ever get Woody Guthrie into a comedic satiric box, and get, that's what he'd do. He'd travel around, he'd sing his songs about the rights of people.
Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on release.
Stony says his job is to just keep ranting about the rights of people and being as loud as possible until conditions change.
It's a slow thing. You know, it's definitely not a mass media thing. It's something where even in the first time you look at me, you go, oh, who's the homeless guy yelling? This is just what they warned me about in Berkeley. And I think it gives them courage to see when people go on a rant about something that they feel passionate about. You know, we're always told to keep it under control and, you know, keep the, with what little credibility I have flowing through my veins like the Rio Grande. I'll tell you right here, we need to recall all the politicians. That's right, round them up.
Stony continues to rant and rave. These days, officers walking by pause to give him a stern look and then saunter away.
I'm not invited here. No one said, Stony, you can be here. A list of arrests would back up the fact that they really don't want you here. On the other side, I try to train myself to get in, you know, the dream of having a revolution.
We're still waiting, we're waiting on the world to change.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Julie Napolin.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Kimberly Brownlee, professor of political philosophy at the University of Manchester, co-editor of Disability and Disadvantage, and she writes on various topics in moral, political, and legal philosophy, including the topic of civil disobedience. Kimberly, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, Ken. Hello, John. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thanks for coming. Now, Kimberly, you wrote a very fine article for the Stanford Encyclopedia on civil disobedience. It's clearly a topic you care deeply about. What led you to this interest? Can you tell us briefly?
I think one reason I became interested in the topic was, you know, it started in an admiration. When I was studying in my undergraduate work on philosophy, I was very enamored with characters who were willing to sort of expose themselves to the judgment of their community, to accept censure. You know, someone like a Socrates or Bertrand Russell, John Stuart Mill, thinkers who were willing to be sufficiently independent-minded that they could, you know, challenge the status quo, endure censure, and nonetheless had the conviction to back up their beliefs. And I think that courage that it takes to be the gadfly was part of what drew me to this topic, because it's not only the thinkers in, you know, the ivory towers and you know, in academia who should be independent-minded, but people, you know, who are actively part of the community. And what made those philosophers special was that they were willing to be active members of their communities.
So for our young philosophers out there that might want to crawl out of the ivory tower and be civil disobeyers, can you tell us what in your analysis makes converts a breach of the law into a true act of civil disobedience?
Right. Well, I think in your opening, John and Ken, you hit on some very, you know, central features of a paradigm case, and, you know, or what's often cited as the key features, you know, one of them being nonviolence, the other key feature being, you know, a conscientiousness, you know, very clear set of intentions to engage communicatively with the community, to sort of make people sensitive to a certain injustice. Now there are debates about whether those indeed are the core features, you know, and the nonviolence feature is actually quite a tricky one, because, you know, philosophers, we love to play with concepts, but there's a big question of, you know, what is it for something to be violent? Is an act of vandalism, is, you know, sort of painting on the walls of a public space, is that an act of violence because it's, you know, damaging property?
Well, I would think that nonviolence... Well, I was going to say something that I now don't believe, but nonviolence, violence against persons is one thing, right? Direct violence against persons, and damage to property is another thing. Sometimes if the property is highly valuable, then damage to property can be, people who go around blowing up buildings, you know, it can be, but sort of defacing property, it's not exactly violence against property, is it?
Right. Well, and I guess then the question is, when we're talking about sort of what we would view as violence to persons, harm to persons, you know, if you look at different ways that people can protest, some acts that are clearly not violent, like a legal strike by ambulance workers, can in fact do far more harm to people than what might be viewed as a modest act of violence. You know, people at animal rights protests catapulting stuffed animals at the police. Well, you know, the police are going to get hit with stuffed animals, and, you know, that's sort of mild violence to a person, but it's, you know, not the same kind of thing as, you know, the harm that would be done through an ambulance protest.
The idea of civil disobedience doesn't entail, like, you don't do harm. I mean, because some acts of civil disobedience can be highly consequential and have very severe downside causes. Cost for the society at large, and the civil disobeyers can intend that, can't they?
Yes, and I think that's, you know, one of the sort of big questions when you're trying to make a case for why this method of protest is a defensible one, is that it's often viewed as having a very negative impact for the society, and so, you know, the sort of the point you raised about our democratic procedures, the sort of the proper process or being politically engaged, that's usually the challenge put to someone who resorts to breach of law, that they've somehow stepped outside the bounds of what's, you know, what a society can legitimately tolerate.
So we're going to have to take that up and discuss it in some detail in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing civil disobedience with Kimberly Brownlee from the University of Manchester.
In our next segment, we're going to ask when and if civil disobedience is morally justified. The Bay Area is a famous center of civil disobedience, from Vietnam to the gay rights movement and lots of other times. Have you ever engaged in civil disobedience? What were the consequences for you and for the law you were protesting? Tell us. Join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
The morality of civil disobedience, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Support Philosophy Talk and help keep us on the air.
Keep your brain exercised. All programs are available for download at philosophytalk.org.
Stand up for something you thought was right, even if it meant breaking the law? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. We're discussing civil disobedience. Share your experiences and thoughts. How far would you go to protest an unjust law? Would you risk a penalty for not paying taxes? Risk imprisonment? Would you risk your life? The toll-free number, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Kimberly Brownlee from the University of Manchester.
Kimberly, so look, we admire people like Thoreau and Gandhi and many others who have engaged in acts of civil disobedience. That's, you said that's how you got started thinking about this stuff, out of your admiration for such people. But I want to ask you a question about moral rights. Do we really have the moral right, especially those of us who live in a democratic system, to disobey a law just because we think it's wrong or unjust?
Yeah, well, and that is, you know, usually sort of the question that judges try to grapple with when they're trying to respond to civilly disobedient actors. They sort of say to dissenters, you are improperly giving to yourself license to disregard the law that, you know, you're expecting other people to follow. And sort of the motto of, you know, that view is no man or woman is above the law. But, you know, the response to that is that, you know, our democratic process doesn't have an endpoint. It's not that, you know, sort of the votes are taken, the votes are counted, and, you know, that's the end of the matter. This is the law, and you know, debate, you know, now has to be shut down. And many people, many philosophers who look at civil disobedience and defend it say that, you know, in fact, this mechanism of resorting to suitably constrained forms of illegal protest, that's how you regenerate democratic debate when a discussion has been silenced or, you know, neglected. This is a way of correcting for a democratic deficit. The famous philosopher John Rawls, about whom I think you had a session a couple weeks ago, he argued that justified civil disobedience is a way of stabilizing a democratic society. It's a way of highlighting injustice and, you know, sort of bringing it to the attention of the majority and trying to work toward, you know, a positive solution.
So would it help here to think about cases where we not only maybe have, it's not just morally legitimate to disobey the law, but morally required? There's a famous story that I probably don't have quite right, where Ralph Waldo Emerson walks by Thoreau when he's in jail and says, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau says, well, Ralph Waldo, or whatever he called him, what are you doing out there? And we have an email on this topic. This is from Fred, and Fred says, I absolutely agree that we can't have civilization without government by rule of law, but I recently read Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem. Could you comment on what someone like Eichmann should have done, given that he certainly maintained that he was obeying the law? That is, we seem to think Eichmann not only would have been morally okay to disobey the law, he was morally required to disobey the law. So does that help think about that as kind of an extreme case on the underside?
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, that's the kind of question Martin Luther King raised as well, is, you know, which is the worst abuse of the law, the unjust law that a Congress has passed, or, you know, the act of disobeying that law. And many who champion the rule of law and the norms of the rule of law would say that, you know, norms of generality and predictability and transparency, they're not simply procedural, that they actually have a substantive quality to them, that, you know, the laws, you know, while they might still, you know, yes, they're laws, you know, we, you know, if they're passed in the right, through the right process, we'll call them laws. But there's still laws we ought not to follow. And we make a mistake when we think that, well, we have a general duty, a general moral duty to follow the law, even if it's a really, you know, an indefensible one.
Okay, but let's go back to Ken's example earlier of the abortion protesters. So we've got Roe versus Wade. Many people deeply believe it's wrong. And some disobey the law or disobey some other law to protest that, sometimes violently, like by blowing up an abortion clinic, but sometimes nonviolently, like by blocking the entrance. Now, let's just assume for the sake of argument that they're wrong and that Roe versus Wade is an okay law or interpretation of law. Does the permissibility of their act depend on them being right about what they're protesting, or is it permissible just because they believe they're right about what they're protesting?
Well, it depends. If we're talking about whether they have a moral right to engage in civil disobedience, then the sort of the rightness or wrongness of their convictions is independent. It's irrelevant because rights are there to protect us when we're going to make bad choices as well as good choices. You know, that's what it is to have a right. You have a protected sphere of autonomy within which you can act. So you have a right to free speech so that you can say the things people don't want to hear and the things they won't like, not just the things that people, you know, might like.
But wait a minute. The law doesn't present itself, and our democratic creation of law does not present itself as something that, okay, it's up to you whether you accept this law. I mean, it's not like it's a cafe where a cafeteria where you say, here's a law I like, here's a law I think is, you know, isn't there some kind of duty, especially in a liberal democratic polity, to respect the law, some general duty that would be hard to override?
Well, when you look at the various arguments that are offered on behalf of such a duty, they're actually hard to sustain. Some of them take the form that, we have consented in some implicit or explicit way. You know, we vote, we take advantage of the benefits of our society, we use the roads and the hospitals and so on, and therefore we sign up for this legal system, and that creates this general moral duty to follow the law. But, you know, we can question that. We're born into a society. We don't choose to become a part of a society. And even if we leave this society, we'll just end up in another society where, you know, there'll be similar demands upon us. So we might say, okay, well, the consent argument maybe isn't going to work, but we can say that we have this general moral duty to follow the law, except maybe in the really serious circumstances, because having a legal system is a good thing, that, you know, we need to coordinate, government needs to be able to coordinate its activities, and this democratic process is vulnerable if we challenge it too much. And again, that's sort of the question is, what kind of activity is most promoting those good institutions? And when you have someone like Al Gore saying at the Clinton Global Initiative last September that, you know, young people, you should be out engaging in civil disobedience against coal plants that aren't using processes of carbon capture, because that's what's needed in order to put proper pressure on governments and businesses to, you know, preserve these good institutions.
It's a complicated question, no doubt. And I'm sure our callers want to weigh in here. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about civil disobedience with Kimberly Brownlee from the University of Manchester. And we'd love to have you join this conversation. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or as always, you can email us at philosophytalk.org. And we've got Christina from El Cerrito on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Christina.
Hi.
Hi. What's your comment, question?
Well, I was a part of a group of people who committed civil disobedience, and I wanted to make a comment regarding what we did.
Go, shoot.
This was in 1978. There were 250 of us who committed civil disobedience at the PG&E nuclear power plant in San Luis Obispo, and it was very well organized. But the purpose, the reason I called, the purpose of that action, there were also 250 people who were support people slash monitors, and it was very well organized. We went into it knowing that we were going to be arrested and we were going to go limp. We weren't going to, it was totally nonviolent. We were also going to not pay bail, and we were going to go to jail. The purpose was to clog up the system, get lots of attention from the media, and educate the public about the link between nuclear power plants and the proliferation of nuclear weapons, about the weapons that were being developed. Now, it was very successful. So it was educational on purpose.
Okay.
And I just wanted to kind of make that comment because I think that that's an extremely valid reason for committing civil disobedience is to educate the public.
Okay, Christina, thanks for the call. Thanks for the comments. Kimberly, what do you think?
I think Christina's entirely right that that is, you know, one of the core valuable parts of civil disobedience and why some of the sort of the strategic methods used are important because they can either enhance or detract from that educational value. So, you know, being conscientiously nonviolent in a very specific way can have a lot of strategic value in that it doesn't change the debate. It helps to keep the focus on the issue that you're most concerned about, in this case, you know, the use of nuclear power and nuclear weapons. That I think that Christina's right, that, you know, the educational part of civil disobedience, the waking people up, making people uncomfortable, that is a core part of its contribution to our communities.
Join this conversation, 1-800-525-9917. We're talking about civil disobedience, and Tony, also in El Cerrito's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tony.
Hello. My question is, while I have participated in civil disobedience, I've been wondering about what the responsibility is for those who plan civil disobedience in terms of things they haven't planned for, such as general damage to those people who are not involved in it, or those people who are involved and hadn't planned for it to get out of hand. And I mean it in both directions. When police get out of hand, or when perpetrators of the civil disobedience get out of hand and do a lot of general damage.
Good question, Tony. Kimberly, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, Christina's observation that her group was very well organized, I think that's key, that sort of the better organized your group can be and the more you've anticipated sort of likely responses from police and from, you know, the court process, you know, the better you can, and, you know, take care of your responsibilities, because I think that's, you know, that is an important piece of being a conscientious actor, that you're sensitive to, you know, the possible damage you'll be doing to, you know, if you're holding up, if you're doing a sit-in or so on.
Sometimes if your attention is to bring a halt to a consequential public policy, a war, you know, an unjust occupation or something, as in Gandhi's case, or to end segregation, as in Martin Luther King's case, you want things. I don't know if to get out of hand, but you want to grind the wheels.
To get some attention.
You want to grind the wheels of this unjust public policy to a halt.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's probably right. There's a bit of a balance there. You know, some judges have been lenient in their treatment of conscientious actors when those actors sort of engage with the police in a certain way. So, for example, Justice Alan Hunter in Maine, when he was trying some people who had engaged in a sit-in in protest of the Iraq War in the Bangor, Maine Federal Building, he was lenient toward them because they hadn't gone limp upon arrest. They hadn't made the police officer's job more difficult by making it harder to arrest them. That, you know, they were sort of playing fair, that, you know, they wanted as much publicity as possible, but they were still showing a certain, you know, respect for the system and its, you know, its formal processes. So like there's this tension between wanting to get much, you know, some publicity and wanting to be sufficiently sensational that, you know, society will attend to you, but at the same time, you know, showing that you're, you know, you're not terrorizing people, you're not being coercive, you're trying to persuade and make people think, not trying to overwhelm. Or
I think there's a difficulty. Maybe it's not a philosophical difficulty, but to have the a civil disobedience movement be significant, you need a lot of people. And when you get a lot of people, it's easy to drift into something that's not merely civil disobedience, but an active attempt to stop things, not through education, but by interposition of your bodies, which may be justified too, but it's a little bit different. My own memory is after being a student, I became a faculty member in 1968, and I remember we decided, a group of faculty members once, that we should interpose ourselves between the police and the student demonstrators. So there was a line of faculty between these police.
You're a human shield.
They were protesting a regents meeting, and this wasn't my idea, and I immediately began to have doubts about how good an idea it was.
Yeah.
But the students were more frightening than the police.
We've got lots of callers on the line. Brian from Menlo Park. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Brian.
Oh, hello. I'm wondering if you think an act of violence is justified if it's permitted against something of sufficient evil. For example, was the attempt to murder Adolf Hitler justified because he was perceived as a figure of great evil? And if we can say yes to that, was the actual assassination of Abraham Lincoln justified because he was perceived by millions to be a figure of great evil?
I think, thanks for the call. I think assassinating Hitler was justified, but I don't really put that under civil disobedience because, I mean, for example, we were at war with Hitler and we could do anything we can to stop him. And those who were his victims, I think they were justified in doing anything to stop him. But I don't think you need concepts of civil disobedience to think about how to deal with evil. Well, what do you think, Kimberly?
No, I would agree. And, you know, we want to be careful not to become too sort of consequential in our thinking about, well, if it brings about a good end, then, you know, whatever means we need to use are defensible means. I think people who are, you know, civilly disobedient in the paradigmatic way of, you know, being nonviolent or, you know, public, engaging with the law in a certain way, that they're very conscious of the process. You know, Martin Luther King said that the ends must be just ends, but the means we use must be equally just. It's not, like, he was very critical of Malcolm X for being willing to use extreme types of measures in order to, you know, achieve emancipation.
I mean, I think there's a big important thing. You have to distinguish between what justifies acts of civil disobedience in a basically just liberal society where there are many other means available versus when you're in a repressive, oppressive, totalitarian state. I mean, those are really morally different situations, I would think. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing civil disobedience with Kimberly Brownlee from the University of Manchester.
How should the government react to acts of civil disobedience? Should protests be treated just like other breaches of the law? We'll look into that in our next segment.
Punishing acts of civil disobedience, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The first 5 years of Philosophy Talk are now available in a single package.
Every purchase helps keep Philosophy Talk on the air.
Details at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Spar down to Isla Vista, where police felt so harassed. They called the special riot squad. The L.A. County Sheriff would let us arrive.
From student demonstrations to civil disobedience, how should governments treat lawbreakers who claim the moral high ground? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Kimberly Brownlee from the University of Manchester, and we have a whole lineup of callers on the line. Jay from San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thank you. I think it's Kant's idea. I'm not sure about the test, ethical test about generalizing your behavior if everybody acted that way. And,
right, the categorical imperative.
Yeah, and how that would pan out if the process would become just too unwieldy if everybody acted on a civil disobedience manner.
Right, so what are you wondering?
The question is, does it pass that test?
Yeah, does it pass the test? Because would it just be too chaotic if everybody acted in that way?
Good question, Jay. Kimberly, what do you think?
I think that is sort of the worry, and many theorists would say that, well, for that reason, if you're going to engage in civil disobedience, you should pay some penalty. That, you know, even if your cause is a good one, and even if the judges actually agree with you about the value of your protest, that you should pay a penalty that's a sufficiently high one that it's going to deter people who aren't very serious about engaging in this kind of protest. And my worry with that kind of argument is it's suggesting that, you know, we can, you know, and we're not being very Kantian when we do impose that penalty, because we're saying to you that, well, we can treat you as a means. We can sort of make an example of you so that other people won't be inclined to, you know, engage in protest unless they're really serious.
So, Kimberly, you raised the question that is like at the heart of this segment. So what should the law or the courts do to a civilly disobedient person? I mean, you can let them off scot-free because they had acted from these noble motives. You can punish them the same as other people. You can punish them more harshly than other people. You might want to punish them more harshly than other people because not only did they commit the crime, but they said, hey, I was entitled to commit the crime because I'm morally superior. You might want to bat them down. So how should the law think about the civil disobedient when it comes to punishment?
I think it's actually quite tricky because, as Chief Justice McEachran of British Columbia pointed out, civil disobedience is not a legal concept. There's no offense of civil disobedience. So, you know, when you engage in civil disobedience, you know, you're claiming that you have a different intention, that you should be treated differently. But, it is a philosophical notion, not a legal one. That said, some judges have taken the view that there is a value in being made to feel uncomfortable. Justice Hunter of Maine, whom I mentioned before, he said that, you know, there have been great acts of civil disobedience in our history that have helped to, you know, expand the moral horizons of our community. And so civilly disobedient people should be treated more leniently for that reason. There are lots of cases that don't take that view. And certainly as you get into the appeal court cases, the line tends to be much more, you know, judges' job is to uphold the rule of law, and you read about judges saying, my hands are tied, I can't, even though I agree with you, I can't in fact treat you differently than an ordinary offender.
It is a difficult question, but it seems to me part of the dynamic is supposed to be that we disobey the law, and the law is so obviously unjust when you think about it and draw attention to it, that the judges will not feel good about enforcing the law. I mean, we take the risk that they won't feel that way, but in a strange way, it sounds counterintuitive, but you think the judge should pay attention to whether they think the protest was legitimate
but
or not. If they think it was so legitimate, then maybe they should break the law too.
But part of what civil disobeyers do in being conscientious civil disobeyers is to embody respect for the law. And part of that respect for the law is, I think, willingness to accept the punishment. So if I'm willing to accept the punishment and it's the law and you're the judge, I mean, I don't quite see why you should not punish me.
Well, though, you know, some civilly disobedient people were quite happy to accept the punishment, but it didn't actually indicate what you might think it was indicating in terms of, you know, I'm supporting the community and so on. You know, someone like Gandhi was very happy to go to jail for his civil disobedience, but he wasn't the least bit supportive of the British regime that was punishing him. So I don't know how much we want to take away from this idea of a willingness to accept punishment. But there is, you know, the sort of broader question of, you know, how to understand this kind of activity. And, you know, some thinkers are trying to develop under-examined defenses, you know, the idea of a demands of conscience defense, that, you know, we put too much emphasis on law-abidingness when we say there's no defense for someone who, you know, deviates from the law because they couldn't act otherwise.
Yeah. Sorry. Complicated stuff. Millie from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Millie.
Hello. Interesting. Thank you very much. I wanted to observe that I think, in a way, you folks are being too nice about what the law is. You are, of course, quite legitimately thinking about a relatively liberal, enlightened society, ours. But we have had 5-4 Supreme Court decisions on very important issues, and we have lawless regimes like things that functioned in New Orleans at the time of Katrina and after. And sometimes breaking the law is a moral obligation, or maybe even an emotional obligation, I would think, for which one has to take the consequences, and they may be cruel.
No, Millie, I totally agree with you, and I think when we're not talking about a basically decent liberal society, whose laws are by and large just, and ours wasn't always that, then I think it becomes much more fraught. The burdens on you to not go along with that become much higher. So I agree, Kimberly. What do you think?
I think that's right, and you know, and much of the philosophical writing about civil disobedience does focus on the liberal context, with sort of the assumption being made that in a less liberal regime, a more intolerant regime, that, you know, if you don't have to make a case for civil disobedience, because, you know, that's sort of the modest form of protest, you know, that you're probably entitled to use even more extreme measures. In the liberal context, it is somewhat heartening when you hear Barack Obama, you know, supporting, for example, the workers at Republic Windows and Doors who occupied their workplace after it was closed, and, you know, and demanded that their rights be honored and so on. Or if you hear Al Gore telling young people to go out and civilly disobey, that yeah, the sort of sense that this is a potentially legitimate protest, and one which, you know, judges and lawyers and legal theorists need to give a bit more attention to, and maybe open up some legal space and give some legal terminology to, because it's a very common type of activity, and it tends to just be treated in such a haphazard way because there's no sort of agreed upon sense of what it is, its legal status is.
Well, Millie makes a very good point, I think, but you might say, well, you know, it may be that America, the United States, scores pretty well compared to the competition on procedural justice. We do actually have democratic procedures, and with all their problems, they work pretty well compared to the most of the societies in history. On the other hand, in terms of consequences, we're so big, so powerful, have so much to do with the world's economy, and completely monopolize the world's weapon systems, that the consequences of what we do are whatever fair procedures led to bad decisions, they have terrible consequences. And I must admit, I sometimes think that we should all be out on the streets all the time.
I agree. And academics, we should be encouraging our students to be out there more than they are.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think you're right. But I do think we kind of let the civil disobedience a little easy off the hook, because there got to be limits and constraints. And we haven't had much time to talk about that at all.
But that's a good warning note to end on.
Yeah, on that note, Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, John.
Our guest has been Kimberly Brownlee. She's professor of philosophy at the University of Manchester, co-editor of Disabilities and Disadvantage, and she writes a lot about topics like civil disobedience. So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, I learned today that it's a delight to have a clear-thinking, clear-talking, articulate guest like Kimberly Brownlee. In preparing for the show, I must admit, civil disobedience, it's not something I've ever taught about. It's not something I've ever done research about. And so to read up on it was quite interesting. I engaged in some very minor civil disobedience that back during the Vietnam War, sat in a building where we didn't have permission, and I never burned my draft card publicly, but I did erase it in private.
So. Yeah, right. I don't think that constitutes an act of
chickadee,
civil disobedience.
civil disobedience, but I didn't think much of it as a philosophical issue there, but it raises a lot of interesting points.
Yeah, I do think it raises a lot of interesting points, and I really wanted to, I wish we had had time to think more about, you know, the limits, when it's called for and when it isn't. Because, I mean, I think it is often called for. It is often something that we're entitled to engage in. But it can't just be anything goes. The law is not just an option. right? And I don't conceive of the law as just an option to obey or disobey. But sometimes I am called to disobey it. So how do you reconcile these two things, the non-optional status of the law with the right to disobey? I think that's a fascinating question.
Well, I think that also the absolute duty to disobey falls upon people like us that have tenure, or retired people like myself that don't need jobs. So it's an interesting subject.
Conversation continues on our blog and on our Facebook page.
Now, you can download podcasts of our program, too, by the way, from our website. Just go to our website and follow the directions. Now we're going to try to help a listener think through a real-life problem using the tools of philosophy. We call this a conundrum.
So, John, we have a very special conundrum on the line. This caller has requested anonymity.
Hi, caller. What should we call you?
Pat is a good name.
Okay. Hi, Pat. What's your conundrum?
My conundrum is that I am an assistant to a CEO of a small company, and our relationship has been very good over the years that I've worked with this person. But last year, this employer decided to, what he called, reformat a department, and fired the manager, and then we embarked on a high-powered national search for someone new, and it was really, in retrospect, a complicated, intricate construct put into motion many months earlier to result in this CEO hiring his girlfriend to fill the position. And this person is not qualified for the management position she finds herself in. And she was by no means the pick of the other people who were involved in the process. So this has created a difficult environment for us. People understand and recognize that they were lied to as a whole and individually, and that's kind of how the work environment is now.
Pat, just let me ask a clarificatory question. I got the sense originally that although he's CEO of the company is in fact part of a larger organization, that so he has somebody besides himself that he answers to in terms of spending all this money?
That is correct. He does answer to a loose governing board of directors.
So part of your conundrum is whether you have a moral obligation to tell them?
Yes, that would seem the right course of action, but I don't believe it would result in anything other than my firing.
Ah, so now I'm beginning to understand your conundrum. There's a situation that nobody's willing to do anything about it. Lots of people know about it. Nobody's willing to do anything about it. You think you might be able to do something about it by informing the board, but you don't have any confidence that it would bring about a result other than damage to you. And you're not a martyr, right? I mean, you don't want to be a martyr.
No, but I also don't want to hurt anyone else, because several people have expressed great rage to me about what they know, but everyone is afraid for their job, and all history points to anybody who is labeled a troublemaker losing their job rather quickly.
Pat, let me ask you a different kind of question. Before this incident, you had a high degree of respect for this CEO. You worked closely with him?
Yes.
Did you consider yourself a close friend of his or just a coworker?
Somewhere in between. I thought we had a strong professional relationship that was also friendly.
What about when your friend does something wrong, you go directly to your friend? If you have you say, I think you shouldn't have done this. I think you're ruining this workplace. I think you need to look at this again and rethink. Could you do that?
I actually already did, but believe me, nothing good came of it. I didn't lose my job, but I think he is very clear on where we both stand now.
So now that you know he's capable of this behavior, it does change your moral situation, it seems to me, in that you now have to realize that you have to be careful, because you don't want to be involved in this. It may be something that you can't stop. You certainly can't go back and reverse history. It may be something you can't redress. at a reasonable personal cost or at all, because telling the board would just result in your getting fired and not undoing the situation or his being punished. But you can't avoid being involved in the future. That seems to me the first obligation that you have, the most important one. And it sounds like maybe you've already completed it, that you've explained to him that you regard this as unacceptable behavior and as something you wouldn't want to have been involved in and don't want to be involved in the future. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I want to echo Don just a bit. I mean, I think this is kind of a morally unfortunate situation in the following sense. I don't think there's anything much more that you can do without deciding to be a saint or a hero, right? And you're not obligated to be a saint or a hero. You're not obligated to hurt yourself to better this situation, right? And if you, but I know you want internally to do something about it. But sometimes we just have to accept the limits possible from our own, you know, moral agency. There are just limits to what you can do and achieve to improve a situation, right? There aren't really any great options available to you except living with this morally distasteful situation and protecting yourself.
Yes, I think that is where it is.
I thank you for your conundrum. It's a very gripping one, and I hope somehow the situation improves.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.